It's All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. There's a new album from Broken Bells, and you're about to find out how it all came together. This is an interview with Brian Burton, also known as Danger Mouse, and James Mercer, you know, the leader of the Shins. This is their second project under the Broken Bells name. I'm here with Robin Hilton of All Songs Considered. We're in Washington, D.C. And at NPR West in Culver City, California, is Brian Burton. And in Portland, Oregon, is James Mercer. I'm playing right now the opening cut from After the Disco, the new Broken Bells record. It comes out January of 2014. James Mercer kicks off the conversation talking about that leadoff song, Perfect World.
That particular song, was that the one that we actually took some inspiration from Jan Hammer? Oh. 80s.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds like you broke out the Yamaha DX7 for this one, right out of like 84 or something.
Yeah. This was probably recorded, I want to say, maybe halfway through the album. I'm trying to remember how it came about. I think I was just doing some arpeggiated synthesizer things, and then we probably came up with a chord progression ourselves and then just started putting instruments to it, and that hook came somewhere along the lines.
Let's hear the hook for a second. I guess the big news for anybody who wants to know is that A, you worked in a room together making music. I mean, this is not something that you, Brian, or you, James, put together a little bit and handed to somebody, handed to the other, right?
No.
And has that been true of both projects?
Yeah, no, everything is the two of us getting together. It's almost like it's an excuse for us to hang out is to make music. So that's, you know, everything is that way. And that's why a lot of times I think it gets a little blurred as to who did what sometimes or where the ideas came from, because they just did. And I think this record, we got even, I guess, more comfortable so we... I don't know. I'm really surprised, actually, thinking back that I don't remember exactly how that song happened, because usually I do, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I remember when it did happen, though, that it kind of felt like, okay, well, there's like a shamelessness to it, like, you know, with the keyboard sound and the real over-the-top melody. It was just like, so what, man? This is, you know, we grew up listening to things that they were big, but they were sad, too. So I was like, well, we can be big as long as it's as sad as we kind of have in the music. It's just there. So we didn't really dial it back too much once we did this song, I think.
So who were you listening to? Who were you thinking of?
Oh, I mean, I don't know.
A lot of it comes from the sound of the equipment. You know, it just harkens back to those dramatic synth-based songs, maybe from the 80s.
That really was a question of production with those songs, because there are some that I've heard since then that have been stripped back or maybe done acoustic and you hear them in a completely different light. But, it's totally a production.
Flock of Seagulls, maybe.
Yeah. I was thinking The Cure.
Yeah.
But the thing with this, the one thing I remember was that there's kind of two parts to this song. And I think at that point we had already done the song After the Disco, and we had been thinking about it, I think. And so we kind of had two ways of presenting the song. And instead of picking one, we did both. So it starts out one way, and then the second half of the song is kind of heavier in halftime. It's more of a downer, I guess, in a way. But that kind of went with the whole After the Disco thing. Like, there's the party, and then there's the thing that happens the next day. And so that song kind of had both. It had the faster thing, and then it went to the morning after, kind of within the same song.
We hear some of that.
I was hoping for an easy rambling life till an ocean came to my mind. We look for exit signs, but we can't be changed into nothing overnight. Though we know it's over, it keeps exploding every morning when we rise.
You got me there.
There are a lot of great changes in these songs. I feel like there are like three or four songs in one song. Is that a product of one of you handing it off to the other, or?
I don't think they're handing,
you know,
right?
You know, I don't mean in separate rooms. I mean, you know, like, collaborating on the writing process of it.
I think we come up with a lot of production ideas and then change our minds halfway through, but we still sort of love the idea, the original idea, so we sometimes tag it on at the end, Brian.
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing that happens is a lot of times if there's a basis for an idea that we like, something really simple, we search for something to go on top of it, something else that makes us react to it. And some of those reactions, sometimes we'll have two or three reactions that we really like that don't necessarily have to do with each other, except for that they came from the same inspiration. So I'll be listening to James sing to something, and I'll be a fan of a bunch of the things that he did, and it'll be hard for me to pick. So I'll go, let's use two or three of these things. And the one thing that holds it together is that it still came from the same bed of music. So then you can use them, and they do still make sense.
And then the words, which are, I'd say the words are pretty hopeful. So there's that, who wrote the line that, who wrote any of these words? Who did this?
Oh my God, who wrote this?
the line, we look for exit signs where we can't be changed into nothing overnight. And though we know it's over, it keeps exploding every morning when we rise.
Oh, gosh, it could have been either
remember?
One of us.
Yeah, is that true? Yeah. I think that's a bit of both of us there.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean,
describe that. I mean, do you both sit around a computer trying to figure out singing words to each other and typing them as you go? Or
no.
So, well, we're listening to the music, and we've got some notepads, and we're coming up with ideas and talking about what we hear as meaning, you know, in the music and stuff.
Most of the lyrics are actually, I guess, if you look back on it now, when you're in the middle of doing them, it seems kind of tedious. But then when you look at it afterwards, most of them actually came from things that were outside the studio, conversations outside the studio and us knowing each other. It's almost like, you know, that movie Usual Suspects, where the guy's like looking at all the things around the room and describing a whole story based on that. And then next thing you know, you have this whole story that just came from what everything he saw. It's kind of the way the lyrics were done here, where all the conversations and hanging out me and James do outside the studio winds up finding its way into the record. Because we're different, a little bit different now than we were a couple of years ago when we did this. But it's the same thing happened the first time around. But I think with this one, we did most of them together. Like, we waited till we were done with most of the music and melodies. And then we kind of went in and wrote pretty much all the lyrics in about a week, probably. You know, something like that, right? Yeah. Wasn't it that 1 week, James, where we did majority of the lyrics, where we sat down and just made ourselves go for it?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
We put it off till the last minute.
So there's a lot of themes. There's
had to finally do it.
Yeah. There's some common themes here going on in this.
There's some smoking cigarettes night and day.
Well, it's interesting because it sounds like such a personal record. It feels like a breakup record in some ways. And in collaborations like this, I always wonder, you know, how much of that is inspiration or, you know, working through something emotionally, and how much of it is just, you know, a couple guys in a studio having fun and working hard.
Well, James and I have different lifestyles. We have different lives completely. So
let's hear about some of this.
No, that's all right. That's where I'll start and end.
Mine's boring and Brian's is fun.
No. Well, I guess I have come in contact with, I have more multiple relationships to deal with, and James is married. But still, that's a whole nother complex thing as well. So it's kind of where those things wind up crossing over. It's interesting how you can have a bunch of different relationships that don't have anything to do with marriage, and then you can have one that's this one thing and they still have a lot of things in common. And, you know, some things may sway a little bit more towards my experiences, and some obviously are more towards his. If you know us, or even just that, you can kind of maybe pick out things here and there, but it is interesting how they seem to still work together.
And the difference between, I mean, first of all, this is nice because it's not just a one-off project. We know that you guys are going to be doing this a bunch. I think maybe you probably knew that when you finished the last one. How's the relationship changing?
Between us?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think so.
No?
Not too much. I mean, James, what do you think?
I mean, I think we just know each other better.
Yeah.
It's easier. You know, I remember the first time when I went down on that first occasion to record for the first record, I was nervous, you know, and I hadn't really collaborated like this with anybody, and you know,
meaning
now
being so open-ended and being not knowing
exactly, and just it's sort of a vulnerable position to be in. Brian's this successful producer, and just standing in front of the microphone and scatting, you know, basically melodies into existence and stuff. And now I'm old hat at it, and we have that confidence in each other and trust.
And it also sounds like if I took that description, I would say that Brian was a lot more active in making the music in the last one, and in this one you were working together more making the music. Would that be right?
I don't think so.
No?
Okay. No, I mean, I can see where it might sound that way, but I think that after making that last record, I had a lot of influence of James in what I kind of did as far as trying to come up with melodies and how I went about that. So that might have even affected other things that I had done. But I think by the time we got back to doing this, the process was very similar. But I think just like James said, we were more comfortable. And I think just musical changes, I think maybe taste changes, they changed a little bit, and what you want to do, you know, changes. So that might have reflected a little bit more.
Speaking of reflected, I'm going to play After the Disco, a little bit of that, of the second song, which is also the title track, After the Disco. And I'd like to talk about just the theme and the feeling that you're after on a song like this. So let me play a little bit. You guys hang around and listen to records together? Is that part of your fun?
Yeah, sometimes, yeah.
And was there anything in particular? Because we talked about some of the production 80s style here, and certainly just mentioning disco speaks to the 70s and certainly leaked into the 80s as well. Is that music that you'd listen to together?
I mean, I don't think there's nothing disco about this record to me. I think that it was the line
it's after
out of the song.
The disco. It's after the
yeah.
disco.
Yeah. There was just a line in the song that kind of described a lot of things. It was a line that kind of accidentally happened where it was sung in a certain way, and it sounded like it was saying after the disco. And I thought, well, you know, I think me and James talked about it. I was like, that sums up a lot of things. It's after the party, like the next, like after you find something out or after something happens. And so we just kind of went with it for this song, and then it kind of became a theme. But there's nothing disco, I think, about the album. I didn't think there was anyway.
Yeah,
but
I mean, I listened to I'm just going to back it up just a touch, because
sure.
I didn't think that. I mean, I did think there was something very sort of 70s about something like this.
Yeah, I can hear it.
Human League,
I don't know.
Or something
that's
like that.
To me,
I don't
that's like Aha from 1986,
League or something like that. Yeah,
but all that stuff came out of that.
Sure.
That stuff.
I swear, though. I mean, that was like we were doing lyrics when we even came up with the idea. I mean, the word using the word disco it's a dangerous thing to do, really. I think, or it's just nothing we would have never really done. It's just it fit. It was a cool. I just thought After the Disco sounded cool, and James, I think we just kind of like, well, we'll just use that, and didn't think anybody would think we would make a disco record or anything.
Well, you know, I felt like listening to this one, that James, you backed off your falsetto a little bit mm-hmm. on this record compared to the last one, but then on a cut like Holding On for Life, I thought you're totally channeling Barry Gibb or something.
Right, that's the other thing. See, I heard Bee Gees in something like this. I'm just going to skip randomly to the middle here, which will be close to where the chorus must be.
I'm seeing the white suits, you know, the matching white suits and the synchronized dancing on stage.
There is a zeitgeist about that, of course, these days. And so maybe that's just what happens, that you know, it gets in the air. You hear it in the Arcade Fire record. You certainly hear it in the Daft Punk record. You hear it in a whole lot of records, right? And maybe that's just in the air. And as a listener, you start to glean that, even if it's not there. And if the sound came out in 2002, he wouldn't have thought Bee Gees. But then again,
funny, because I thought that the way the song started, it sounded like a Dre or Ice Cube record from the early
That's
90s
right.
or late 80s, like the way
Let
it starts
hear the
out.
Beginning in just a second.
It just sounds like an old.
No, that's true. That's sort of the sort of I'm blanking on the name of the
it's like my posse's on Broadway or something. I don't know. It's a really...
theremin. It's sort of like a pseudo-theremin sound there at the top.
Yeah, I mean, the last thing we were thinking about was that. And then there's this melody came out of James that sounded... It was like the chorus. It sounded kind of like the Bee Gees a little bit, but yeah, so what? Bee Gees had some good choruses.
Yeah, no,
quite a few.
Yeah. That was one of the first things we did. We did that like the fourth or fifth day, I think, we worked on the new record. The idea came, and then we put it off to the side and readdressed it about 6 or 8 months later.
And where were you, and how many days was this?
We started, a year ago, last October, for a couple of weeks?
Yeah, I was touring a bunch for the last Shins record, and so whenever I had a break, I would hop down to L.A. And so we fit in a week here and there, right?
Yeah.
A week at a time?
I think we did a week and then another week. So
do you then take them home to live with a little bit? Or is it just sit in the studio? I mean, did you take anything out of the studio with
it? I mean, yeah. They were unfinished songs, so we'll leave them until we go to work again. So I think we had a nice 4 or 5 things the first couple of weeks, and then we came back, I want to say February, and then did a full 6-7 weeks straight, kind of, and did the majority of the rest of the record then.
Other musicians? Any?
No, just me and James.
What about like the horns on something like Control? Are those just samples or?
yeah. Well, there's ways of playing. Well, no. We played those. When I say sample, when there's samples, you know, there's instruments, there's ways of doing things where you push it down, you push a button, and it's a real horn playing the thing. So you can do that now.
Right.
Where you play a chord, and it's really, they sampled horns playing a single note. It's not fake horns. You know what I mean? They're real horns, but they're not in the room. So you're playing the lines and everything else. We played them on a keyboard, and it sounded... sounded really good, so we were going to get horns, but we said, well, they're actually are using real horns in this program we're using, so just it sounds like real horns.
Well, and I think it's confusing for some people who don't understand some of that sort of studio stuff, because they hear the word sample and they think,
you took a pre-recorded
line from it, and you didn't. A sample is just they recorded every single note in the scale of these horns, and then...
So they don't sound like bad synthesizer horns. You can go to a bad synthesizer horn and it won't sound like a horn, but now they do sound like horns.
Well, it was very convincing.
We did have some background singers on a few of the songs this time, which is different because we didn't do that the first time, and then we also had... we did have a lot horn on one of the songs on
we had Nate come in.
Nate came and played horns on that one song.
Nate from Bright Eyes. Nate.
Yeah, yeah. He toured with us last time as well. Nate Walcott. What was the song? It was No Matter What You're Told. Other than that, there's strings. Daniel Lupi did string arrangements, which were great. So we did have live strings on the album, but the basics were just James and I just went in and just figured it out.
Did you drum much on this one? I'm hearing a lot of drum machines on it, and I wonder how much live drumming you did.
Most of it's live drums, but I wanted it to sound like a drum machine, so thank you.
No, very good. Well, I'm going to strip it out. You need to send me the stems, and I'm going to lay it up, and I'm going to just make sure everything is precisely
I definitely don't play like a drum machine. No, they have to be made to sound like that. And that's one thing, too, with this record is I think the parts are much more interesting because I'd be playing, and I would have James come out, or James would just come out, and he would suggest ideas, and I just would never... think to do or play, and he'd be standing over top of me. He's like, no, hit this one, that one. And I've never had anybody do that. And it's kind of like when you're producing somebody else or something. And so he was suggesting stuff, and it just made stuff so much better because it was then again a mixture of ideas. And so the drums are much more interesting to me on this record.
And did you do any of that to him while he was singing?
Always.
tell me what would happen. James, how would he get in your face?
Relentless. he just has suggestions about where to go melodically or, don't do the falsetto there, That's his job as a producer.
I'm so fascinated by producers and all the work they do, and you're certainly on the short list, Brian, of my old-time favorites. And I wonder, I listen to records like this, and I always think, I wonder how this would sound if a completely different producer was steering the ship on this, or if James were doing these songs on his own without as a Shins record or something.
Well,
it'd be very different, I would say.
But I will say, though, I think as far as this record is concerned, it is really kind of all in one. I mean, to say the word, to use, like, you know, the word like producer or production, we just did everything together. I mean, and James himself could be a really great producer if he decided to go do that. And I warned him against it and told him not to, but he could, and he did. You know, this record was definitely done in that way. You can't really separate the two because it was writing and recording at the same time. So, you know, one thing would definitely lead to the next when it came to either a melody or a sound or the tempo or any of that stuff would change the other thing. So it was very wrapped in together. It definitely wouldn't be what people would think of as a traditional way of producing.
There's something about Brian's personality that I think gives him an exceptional ability to produce people and help them bring their ideas to light. It's a thing, you know, it's a certain strange Jedi ability, I think, to be a good producer.
Is it a,
I think Brian's being very humble.
Yeah, well, we expect that from him. But is it a, kind of both welcoming and warming? And I mean, what is it?
Threatening.
Yeah, that's the other word.
It's just a lot of things. You know, I don't know. It's a subtle, strange talent.
Probably take us out here. And just thinking about like one major surprise that y'all came up with that feels so different for both of you on this record. Is there anything that happened that just felt like you broke new ground and maybe look forward to playing with on another record, or just something that was just like you never imagined you'd make a song like that?
They might be different for each one of us. What do you think, James?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about Holding On for Life.
Yeah, I thought the same thing, actually.
I just love that chorus. I just love it.
Yeah.
And I love the reference to the Bee Gees, which I admire, you know, so.
Yeah, I'd say the same thing just because I guess musically, from the, you know, the drum beat and everything, I would have never done something so blatantly simple and obvious and in that kind of way on purpose. And I just kind of put it there as a placeholder. And then for it to go in to start the song the way it started, because exactly like you hear it now is the way we started it. We didn't even have chords. It was just like, here's this drum beat and this thing. And then for it to turn into the chorus that sounds like the Bee Gees, just something we never would have done.
I'm going to hear the drums for a second.
Tell me about the years and let me buy an hour. Maybe help me to understand.
So you're going to take this on tour, Brian? You're going to play drums again?
I don't know. Maybe on something. If anything, I'll play some stuff maybe from the last record. And some of the new parts are a little bit harder to do. Again, because James was helping me with them, they sound better, but they weren't necessarily as natural. So I'm not a seasoned drummer, I guess you could say. So I'd rather have somebody who could do it effortlessly, and then I could maybe pay attention to some other things. So I'll probably be doing some. You know, I'll do it if it's easy.
Well, fabulous. Thanks, all. We look forward to the tour, maybe January. The record's in January, right?
Yes.
Yep.
So after the Disco Broken Bells, and usually when the record comes out, you guys are going to be on the road, so maybe we'll see you around. Look forward to it.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thanks so much. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
And the album After the Disco comes out in January. The single is out now. For NPR Music, I'm Bob Boylan, along with Robin Hilton. Thanks to James Mercer and Brian Burton. It's All Songs Considered.